Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. The new book, A Reed Shaken with the Wind, traces the Bear River Marsh from its creation to the last ice age to its current status as an imperiled national wildlife refuge. The author, Andrew Hedges, draws on geology, ecology, archaeology, wildlife biology, and water resource management to explore the natural and human forces that shaped the marsh and contributed to its decline. Covering indigenous relationships with land, market economies impacts, and the intersection of ecology, science, and politics in establishing the Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge, this volume deepens discussions of humanity's place in the environment and efforts to restore balance with our planet. Andrew Hedges is professor of church history and doctrine at Brigham Young University. He's editor of two volumes of the Joseph Smith Papers Journal series and the Brigham Young Journals, Volume 1. He joins us today for the program. Andrew Hedges, thank you for joining us. Thank you so much for being with us. I guess my first question, you cover this in your acknowledgments. You're a professor of church history. This is a book on, kind of science and ecology. So I guess you were able to persuade your bosses there at BYU to let you do this?
Yeah, it wasn't easy. The idea, I think, the overlap that I kind of played on was the idea of stewardship over the creation, taking care of things and being aware. I think before you can really take care of something, you've got to understand where it came from. And that was the pitch that I gave. To be brutally honest, this has just always been an interest of mine. I'm an ornithologist first, a historian second, and this was a way to kind of bring it all together under the rubric, under the heading of stewardship, taking care of the creation.
You dedicate this to your book, to your father, Ward Hedges, who always loved a good marsh, you say. So ornithology, so I guess that would involve you in marshes growing up.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I grew up, with my dad, with my brother, hunting. I actually never hunted the Bear River Marsh, but areas to the south and around here. And it really does. I mean, hunting is a great introduction to the outdoors and to wildlife and having an appreciation for those things. So that fed into it as well.
In your introduction, you say this: the book's genesis came from a visit to the Bear River Marsh. You were looking for tundra swans. Tell me about that. It must be a magnificent bird.
Oh, they are. And we've just barely missed their spring migration. They come through, usually peak numbers are, say, mid-March or so. So they're probably pretty much gone by now. But you'll get tens of thousands in a good year coming through in October and November, depending on the weather. Even into December, and for the fall migration as they're heading south, and then they turn around and do the same thing in the spring, usually around in March or so, and you'll get these vast numbers coming through, and you can often hear them before you can see them. And every year, I do make it a point to get out to watch the swans coming through. It really is fun.
So you do this description, it won't have you do the whole thing in the introduction, but you really paint a picture. I'll just read part of this. You say while you were out there in the Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge, there were mallards, pintails, gadwalls, widgeons, grilled wing, teals. It was like an avian counterpart of a busy downtown shopping mall, a place where everybody goes, partly because everybody else is there, where everybody feels comfortable doing their own thing. However idiosyncratic it might be. Maybe paint the picture a little bit, what it's like to be out there.
Well, when you get in a good spot, and again, part of what really is necessary, binoculars, and if you can do it, a spotting scope, then you can get out there and see the birds at a distance where they're not being bothered and their behavior being altered by, by your presence or somebody else's presence. And it just really is a commotion, different species doing different things And you really do get the feeling that everybody's just kind of glad to be there. They're preening, they're waggling tails, they're bathing, they're feeding, they're resting. And it really does just look like a shopping mall or a park, you know, on a nice Saturday afternoon, where a lot of people just seem to be there just because other people are there. And you know, these wildfowl are very gregarious. They're social animals. And you really get the sense that they just really appreciate a crowd and being part of a crowd.
Let's go back, as you do, to the geology of this area, which has become, over time, we'll talk about this as we go along, the Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge. But the Bear River Marsh, it takes about, I guess, briefly, kind of some more ancient history, how this formed.
Yeah, well, I mean, it forms, it really is kind of a product or a child of the Bear River entering the Great Salt Lake. It's a delta marsh. And in geologic terms, it's actually not all that old. Until about 55,000 years ago, the Bear River did not flow into the Great Salt Lake. It flowed, you know, out of the Uintas, flowed north, and then just sort of kept going north into the Portneuf River. Then the Portneuf eventually makes its way into the Snake, into the Columbia, and out into the Pacific. And that's how it went. And then about 55,000 years ago, you had this some lava volcanic activity around Soda Springs, Idaho, what is today Soda Springs. And you still have that activity going on in Soda Springs. But that lifted up the ground, changed the geography, and pushed, it prevented the river from going north into the Portneuf and turned it to the south. And so that's when the river first entered the Great Salt Lake, was 55,000 years ago. And that would be considered, I think, the birth of the Bear River Marsh. Now, it didn't last long because then you had Lake Bonneville come and, you know, swamped everything under 1,000 feet of water. Lake Bonneville drains off about, you know, roughly 11,000 years ago, somewhere through there. And that's where you would have the modern iteration of the Bear River Marsh as we know it today. There were fluctuations. There's certainly been fluctuations since then. But as far as a marsh goes, and a geographic entity, it really is, you know, only about 11,000 years old or so, with some significant interruptions in the interim.
Tell me about the indigenous people in this area.
Well, they have been part of the marsh from the beginning. So, you know, Bonneville recedes about 11,000 years ago, and the earliest indications we have of indigenous peoples date to about that time, even a little bit before. They seem to have showed up on the scene as Lake Bonneville was just in its final death throes and receding rapidly. And so they've always been part of the scene. People have always been part of the Bear River Marsh. We're not newcomers. We're not interlopers. Humans are charter members of the ecosystem. And they used the Bear River Marsh and other marshes around the Great Salt Lake extensively. A marsh is a very productive, you know, as far as just something that produces raw calories, a marsh is a very productive landscape, especially in a desert area. And they would use the marsh, obviously, for hunting, for gathering eggs, cattails. You know, there's a lot of marsh plants that are edible. And archaeologists have found the Native Americans, indigenous peoples using the marsh to a great extent. That's, in fact, largely why they were here, is it was a food source. It was a resource.
Tell me about the plant life, apart from the, I guess, the constructed area. We'll get into that, the dikes and everything. One, for one example, Phragmites, the invasive plant, which is very pervasive. When did that come in?
That comes in relatively recently, after the floods of the 1980s. So about 1990 or so, you start seeing Phragmites coming in. And huge problem. We'll probably talk about that a little bit later. But, you know, prior to that, the native plants, very well adapted to the unique conditions of the Great Salt Lake and this interface between the Bear River coming in and the salt water. They're halophytic, meaning they're salt loving. The native plants are. They're very well adapted to disturbance and change. They don't do so well when conditions are static. They need kind of a yearly disruption, regular disruption, for them to really flourish and do well. In a way, you could say the Bear River Marsh is kind of like a salt marsh, a tidal salt marsh, you know, on, say, the East Coast, where you've got these big rivers heading into the Atlantic, and twice a day you've got the tide comes in and kind of cleanses them out with salt water, and you've got this brackish, semi-salt water marsh going on. But the Bear River Marsh is different because it didn't have that regular twice-a-day washing. The disturbances were a little more infrequent and potentially more violent than just, you know, a regular tide coming and going. And so it really is a unique environment. And what we found is that the native plant life was uniquely adapted. No surprise, uniquely adapted to these very dynamic conditions. And it's an important point to keep in mind, because when those dynamic conditions are not there, when they're eliminated, which is what happens with management, then the native plants suffer. And I think it gives invasives like Phragmites the opportunity to take over.
You state that you have the three main themes in the book. These are all intertwined, of course. I want to talk briefly about the third theme, that this is the Bear River Marsh is a contested space. It's meant different things to different people over time. Chapter 3 was very interesting to me. It's a theme throughout the book, hunting. The title is The Best Duck Hunting in the World. You talk about a hunt in 1875. And you say that the men who were hunting, I'll just quote this, by today's standards, the story is a remarkable one. Both the sheer number of birds that these men could kill in 3 hours, and for the fact that the four men would kill so many at one time. These were thousands of birds that they were killing.
You had, that hunt that I recount there. This is with the mayor of Corinne, invited some friends from Evanston to come in and hunt. So four guys came in, and he stations them. They take a wagon from Corinne down to a couple miles above the mouth of the Bear River. And he stations two of them on one side of the river, two of them on the other, but staggered. So they're not hunting together, but they're staggered. And then the birds start flying. These guys hunt, four guys hunting for 3 hours, and just keeping up a steady stream of shots. And after 3 hours, when they gathered up all the birds and counted what they had over 1,000 ducks, four guys in 3 hours. It's just astounding, the numbers that must have been there, and the willingness to keep shooting when you've dropped that many birds.
And I can't possibly take all those birds home, right? I don't know. It's just the hunting.
Well, they did. They
did. Oh, okay.
They packed them up in a wagon and then took them back to friends in Evanston. And, Evanston, the town of Evanston for, 2 weeks, ate nothing but ducks because there were so many.
So this is, I guess, similar to attitudes of, somewhat similar to attitudes of where you killed all the buffalo. That kind of thing. I guess part of this is you feel like this is these birds are unlimited.
Well, yeah, and I mean these are attitudes that go way back in colonial times. In Europe, hunting was largely the prerogative of nobility, and your average person couldn't go hunting. And so you get to America, and you've got the freedom from the nobility and the royalty and all of that, and just everybody goes hog wild about the hunting. It's something they couldn't have done before. And so you've got, you know, just this immense slaughter and hunting and this idea that, you know, it's just an unlimited supply. You can find it back in the 1600s, 1700s. And not surprisingly, as early as the 1740s, I've found in records, people complaining that there's, you know, no more waterfowl to hunt. The deer are all gone. There's no hunting anymore. And they attribute it to this unregulated hunting that was going on. But 1740s, they were passing, you know, laws trying to regulate hunting in the colonial period. They didn't go too well. Critics said, you know, you can have the law on the books, but this spirit of freedom that infuses the American soul, nobody pays attention to the laws. And that just sort of marched west, and you did. You saw it with, you know, in the 1880s. By the 1880s, the buffalo are in danger. You had your first extinction in the New World, at least recorded, documented extinction, 1844, with the great auk, great big seabird that seamen would hunt, flightless, easy prey. 1844, you had extinction. 1914, you had the passenger pigeon. That one year, 1914, passenger pigeons go extinct. Carolina parakeets go extinct. And some of it, you know, a lot of it certainly is habitat loss, but a lot of it is just this unregulated hunting. So you see this attitude as the country marches west, especially with the railroad. Coming of the railroad opens up the Bear River Marsh to the rest of the country. And you see people taking advantage of it. And here's this beautiful place loaded with birds, largely untouched. And people pour in and just go wild. And they shot until they ran out of shells, because at that time they did not run out of birds.
Mm-hmm. And so at a certain point, governments feel they need to regulate, right? It's no different here in Utah. What were the early attempts at regulation?
Yeah, well, early attempts, again, back in colonial times, they would try to put limits on, you know, you couldn't hunt at night. Or you couldn't use a gun that was so big, you had to mount it on a swivel, and things like that. And again, didn't really go too well. They tried to put, stop egging, collecting eggs, destroying nests, things like that. In Utah, the regulations, they kick in the late 1800s as bird numbers decline, and they generally dealt with length of the season and bag limits. And they just both kind of reduced, slowly cut down till about 1905 or so. I think in 1905, the bag limit was 25 birds, which, you know, per person, 25, which people just thought was ridiculously low. Hunters did not like that at all. And you could only hunt for about 3.5 months out of the year, whereas before it had been, you know, year round, unlimited. But they saw a need as populations were declining. We've got to do something to prevent another passenger pigeon or Carolina parakeet.
And so this tension, you know, obviously remains to this day. And hunters, interesting. We know the hunters have been influential in conservation, but also, you know, sometimes in excess. Tell me briefly before we go to a break about the controversy, which I didn't, maybe still goes to this day, of lead lead shot versus steel or other ammunition?
Yeah, well, so the lead shot was, as far as waterfowl hunting goes, 1991, there was a national ban on using lead shot for waterfowl hunting. Prior to that time, research had shown that there really were a lot of birds dying, significant number of birds dying from lead poisoning. It doesn't take much. Six pellets, just six, of number six shot, that's the size. It's a fairly small shot. Just six pellets will always kill a duck, research showed. And you get two or three pellets frequently was enough to kill a duck. And even ducks that weren't killed by lead poisoning, they were compromised in their strength, you know, in their ability to fly, in their ability to reproduce, and just a lot of research starting in, I guess it began in the 19-teens with Alexander Wetmore on the Bear River Marsh. The first real research into lead poisoning was by a scientist named Alexander Wetmore on the Bear River Marsh. And he figured out it really was a thing. And then 1950s, 1960s, people nationally start looking at it. 1970s, they took, you know, they did experiments, you know, to see if they could reduce it. And the evidence really was, this is a serious problem with waterfowl. And so 1991, it was eliminated. But when you say, you know, or you ask, is it still a problem today? In some ways, yes. Not so much with waterfowl hunting, but I think the place where it's showing up the most right now is with the California condors. You can still use lead. People do still use lead in hunting big game. And what we're finding with the condors is that people will shoot a deer or an elk or something like that, wound it, and the animal is able to get off and die and not be collected. And then you've got scavengers coming in, including California condors, scavenging the carcass and ingesting the lead fragments from the bullet that killed the animal. And again, it doesn't take very much. And we've got numerous documented cases of condors, very endangered bird, something we're trying to bring back literally from the brink of extinction. Numerous cases of condors dying from lead poisoning from these carcasses that they've scavenged. And so in a way, it still is an issue, just not so much with waterfowl. Mm-hmm.
One more thing on this, I hadn't thought about this. I thought, well, you hunt, you either totally miss the bird or you kill it. But there are, you know, a fair number of wounded birds out there.
Yeah, and that's another issue, too, that I was very surprised at. I think that largely flew under the radar for decades, just how many birds are crippled in the process of hunting. And again, studies, and I cite these in the book, I quote these in the book and cite them so you can look them up. But the best evidence today shows that nationwide, probably for every three birds that are actually bagged and taken home by a waterfowl hunter, two other birds are wounded but escape. They're crippled. And they are consigned to, you know, usually a very slow and painful death, you know, starving to death with freeze up coming, or easy prey for a predator. I guess that would be a quicker death, but still, that just represents, so, you know, if you have a limit of say, what, six birds, and somebody brings home a limit of six birds, on average, according again to fairly good research, they will have probably killed four others. And so they've actually taken 10 birds. Six got home, but four did not, but, you know, 10 birds. And so that's something that needs to be taken into account when government officials set bag limits and things like that. What is the actual mortality when all is said and done?
Well, let's head toward a break now. You were talking with Andrew Hedges. The new book is A Reed Shaken with the Wind, A Human and Natural History of the Bear River Marsh. After the break, we're going to be talking about another theme of the book, which is that this landscape is a constructed landscape. And the whole amazing process of making this marsh into the Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge, dikes and such. We'll talk about that following this brief break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Andrew Hedges. He's the author of a new book. It's called A Reed Shaken with the Wind. It traces the Bear River Marsh from its creation during the last ice age to its current status as an imperiled national wildlife refuge. Andrew Hedges, A Reed Shaken with the Wind. That sounds familiar, familiar phrase. Where does that come from?
Well, if you've read the New Testament, here's my religion background coming out. It comes from there where Christ was talking about John the Baptist, who was, of course, out baptizing in the wilderness. And Christ asks some rhetorical questions to his followers about John the Baptist and said, you know, what did you go out into the wilderness to see? A reed shaken with the wind? Of course, the answer is no, you went out to see a prophet. But that's where the phrase comes from. So it should probably ring a bell for anybody who's muddled their way through Matthew. I think.
All right. Yeah, very good. I'm proud of myself for even having that resonate a little bit with me.
Good.
I must have read that in the Bible somewhere. One of the themes of the book is this is a constructed space now. Did that happen when the refuge was authorized, I guess? And tell me how that process went.
Yeah, well, that's a whole chapter in the book. The parts of the marsh started being constructed, human control, human management, before that, with, some duck clubs coming in, especially the Bear River Club, a little before the refuge was made. But the refuge gets chartered, on paper, it becomes a reality in 1928. Took a lot of work, a lot of behind the scenes finagling to get it passed. But, it's a national wildlife refuge. So this was done by Congress. And what they did, it's a complex story, but you had botulism, which is still an issue today on the marsh, killing some years tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of waterfowl. And there was this desire, how can we get rid of botulism on the marsh? Because the bacteria occurs naturally in the soil. It's an anaerobic bacteria that helps break down vegetation and stuff like that. And under certain conditions, it produces this toxin that, botulism toxin, that of course is very deadly. And so the idea was, well, let's replace the existing marsh with a fresh water marsh. Let's build some dikes, catch the water from the Bear River before it gets out to the lake. And if we can create these freshwater marshes, that will get rid of this botulism. Part of the thinking was, main part of the thinking was, at the time they didn't know it was botulism. They didn't know what caused it. They thought it was poisoning from the alkali salts that were in the soil. So that's why they want to create a freshwater marsh rather than a brackish thing, get rid of the alkali poisoning. And so they get the legislation, they construct miles of dikes. I can't even remember the number, 30 some odd miles of dikes to impound the water. And the idea was that then we would get rid of the alkali poisoning. And the refuge goes operative in 1932. And so it is just, when you go out there today, this is a very different thing than what existed before. Before the dikes, before the refuge, this was a delta marsh. where the river flowed into the Great Salt Lake. And as the Great Salt Lake ebbed and flowed over the course of a year and over many years, the marsh would get cleansed out and, you know, kind of rejuvenated, and regrow and things like that. And with the dikes, though, and the fresh water, you've created a much more static system, much more under human control, and fresh water rather than brackish water. It's not what the native plants were adapted to. And so it's to borrow a phrase from another historian, it's a designer ecosystem, kind of built with human needs, human interests, human biases are behind it, rather than just letting it go like it was naturally. And that constructed ecosystem, I think the evidence is very clear. Looking at, you know, records from the refuge managers themselves, it has created a situation of just very slow but steady decline in the productivity of the marsh.
That's the third theme of the book. Let's go there right now. A long decline in the marsh. So what are the major factors contributing to that?
Well, I mean, you've got, you know, just even before the flooding, even before the Phragmites, the Phragmites today is probably the single largest issue. But when you built the dikes, then you've created, I mean, just as one example, you've created hard, solid ground in what was before just, you know, mud and muck and very spongy ground and things like that. And you've created avenues for predators to come into the marsh in ways that they could not before. And, you know, probably the biggest mammalian predator right now, most dangerous, is just raccoons. Just, you know, go crazy with ground nesting birds, and they can get into the marsh. You've created avenues and places where invasive plants can get established with the dikes as well. And so you've changed the whole ecology of the marsh, what the native plants were used to and what the birds were used to. And so nesting has declined. You know, prior to the dikes, birds nested in the bulrushes, and you had anywhere from 15,000 ducklings produced per year, all the way up, I think it was in the 1960s, the record number of ducklings, according to refuge counts, 79,000 ducklings in 1 year produced. And that's, of course, after the refuge. But in general, there's been a steady decline in the number of ducklings produced because the native vegetation was changed. Ducks started nesting on the dikes. That made them vulnerable to predators that were patrolling the dikes. And just as one example, duckling production has dropped. One of the early managers constructed 10 artificial islands, hoping to lure birds to nest there. And he was hoping for, you know, cormorants and herons and things like that. And they came, but along with them eventually came 5,800 breeding pairs of California gulls. And gulls, of course, love duck eggs. And so the gulls take over the islands and start patrolling the marsh, and just, you know, huge amount of depredation from the gulls. And so managers, this thing just sort of spirals, it snowballs. Managers then start saying, well, we got to control the predators. And so they are killing, you know, hundreds of magpies. Coyotes go, cats come in, and they're hunting cats and skunks and trying to wipe these out. The gulls presented a problem. California gull, ever since the 1950s, was the state bird. and, holds a special spot in the hearts of Latter-day Saints, the predominant religion, because they attribute the goals to reducing the cricket infestations and helping the pioneers survive. So what do you do with these goals? You can kill a skunk and kill a magpie and nobody really cares. They might even applaud you. What do you do about the goals? And so to keep goal numbers in checks, they started spraying diesel fuel on eggs of the goals, trying to suffocate the embryos, and it worked, trying to reduce their numbers. And eventually they reached the point where they had to start shooting goals to reduce the numbers here. But now then, not only do you have the invasive plants, you've got the predators coming in, now you're spreading diesel fuel on the marsh and whatever effects that's going to have. And then with the fresh water, of course, you opened it up to carp, and the carp come in and just make havoc with the native vegetation, especially the pondweed. Very important duck food, but it's also where the invertebrates hide, the larvae that the carp feed on. And so they go through and start ripping up the pondweed, trying to get their invertebrates. And so just all of this cascades, and it takes years. And there's ebbs and flows. And some years everybody thinks everything's going good. But the trend is just a steady, clear decline in the number of birds that are being produced there, in the number of birds that are using the area, in the food that's available. It just sort of gets worse and worse.
Of course, water obviously is going to have an effect. You have a whole chapter on the 1980s and overabundance of water, what that devastation that did to the marsh. Now today, with the opposite problem, talk a little bit about the water levels and what that does.
Well, I mean, they fluctuate. They always have fluctuated. And if we'd been a little more careful when we constructed the marsh, we would have realized here that they fluctuate a lot. when the floods hit in the 1980s, it had been the marsh had been going about the refuge had been going about 50 years or so without any major flooding. And that really was an extraordinarily long time. Looking back on the records of lake levels, that was an extraordinarily long time to go without the Great Salt Lake rising to a point where it would cause problems for the Bear River Marsh. It was good luck, I guess. And so then we get those wet years in the starting in the early 1980s, going through the end of the end of the decade here, and literally flooded the existing refuge in Bear River Marsh out of existence. And wiped out the buildings that were out there, just wiped everything out. And then of course it just drops. And here we are now 40 years later. And, we're just literally fighting for the life, not only of the marsh, but of the lake itself. So we're just in a very dynamic area, part of the country where there's just a lot of fluctuation, and it manifests itself in the Great Basin very dramatically. And it's either kind of feast or famine as far as the water goes. And again, the native plants were adapted to it. Humans aren't adapted to that type of dynamism, though. We like to buy land and have it be there and build a house on it and farm it. And we don't do well when it gets flooded periodically. And our efforts to keep things static have not been in the best interest of the marsh. And sometimes, like in the 1980s, we haven't even been able to keep things static. Nature has overruled us. And now with the so much water use, upstream water use, so many demands on the Bear River water, so many people clamoring for a share of it, the Bear River Marsh, which is, right at the tail end of the river, just kind of gets what's left over. And that's what we're suffering from right now. Because right now, with climate change, with a 20 plus year mega drought well in place, there's often not a whole lot left over for the end of the river.
If you just joined us, you're listening to Access Utah. We're talking with Andrew Hedges. He's author of a new book called A Reed Shaken with the Wind, A Human and Natural History of the Bear River Marsh. We'll have more following this break.
I'm Natalie Gochner, and I'm so excited to be on Utah Public Radio every Thursday at 10 a.m. Join us for a conversation of global, national, and local issues. You can reach out to us at bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Julie Rose, host of the Top of Mind podcast. Traffic stops can be risky for police and civilians, so some departments no longer pull people over for things like expired tags or broken taillights.
After they stopped enforcing these lower-level traffic infractions, reported crime overall went down. Disparities in traffic stops went down. Our officers were safer.
Rethinking traffic stops is Top of Mind.
Tune in Sunday morning at 9 here on UPR.
With us, I'm Tom Williams. You're listening to Access Utah, and we're talking with Andrew Hedges. The book is A Reed Shaken with the Wind, A Human and Natural History of the Bear River Marsh. I want to talk about Chapter 9, Beyond Waterfowl. As waterfowl gets the headlines, there are other birds and wildlife out there. Talk about that a little bit.
Interesting. The refuge was constructed with waterfowl hunting in mind, and increasing the number of birds, making it accessible to hunting, was largely for decades is what drove most of the decisions, it seems, of refuge staff, most of the policies that were put in place. And that hunting was the tradition, and that's what was perpetuated, you know, in the decisions. But what I try to point out in that chapter is that there's just so much more. You can look at it many different ways. If you look at species, about 75% or so of the birds that have traditionally used the marsh were non-waterfowl. You know, that's a good solid majority. You can look at people who visit the marsh early on in 1930s or so. The ratio, even then, early on, was about two people just out to watch the birds per one hunter over the course of a year. You know, the number of bird watchers was twice the number of hunters. People out not just looking at ducks, but at herons and ibises and grebes and everything else that is out there. And then very steadily, over the decades, the number of bird watchers has increased dramatically compared to the number of hunters, until we were, you know, eventually were, at least I think the last statistic I saw, 10 times the number of people out just watching birds, just enjoying it, versus the number of hunters who would go. And part of that is because, of course, you can watch birds year round, whereas hunting is limited to, you know, whatever the hunting season is. And so you've simply got more time for people to be out there. But I think it's an important point. And I think refuge managers have realized that in recent years, that the primary human users of the marsh today, consumers, if you will, aren't those who are hunting, but it's people who are out, you know, just enjoying it. And they too infuse a lot of money into the economy. I know hunting does as well, but bird watching infuses a lot more money into the economy than waterfowl hunting. And I'm hopeful that people will start realizing, not only, and I think, you know, a lot of managers and whatnot have, but others too need to realize this is not just a hunting ground. This is a place to go and just really see some neat things. You go there today, you're not going to see the numbers that were there. We have nothing like the abundance that used to be there, and it's just tragic. I don't know that today we really know what the word abundance means when it comes to wildlife. But you can still get at least representatives and see a few really cool birds. I was out there just a couple weekends ago, and the refuge has opened up a new loop that you can drive on. And I've never been there before, and it was just neat to see all that was out there. So, yeah, we view it as traditionally, I think in a lot of people's minds, oh, that's a place, if you want to see ducks, you go to see ducks. But there's so much more, so many different species out there.
So in the book, you talk about this visit to see the swans, but you encounter, or you're very near, a hen canvasback duck who's wounded, drooping left wing, a limp. You could hear her web feet slapping. She's hobbling along. And you say she might have been a metaphor for the marsh itself. That's doesn't sound very hopeful. What do you think the future of the marsh is?
Oh, that's such a good question. And I just don't know. I'm worried about it. I'm worried about the future of the marsh, just like I'm worried about the future of the Great Salt Lake. And I'm not the only one who's worried about those futures here. It really is a perfect storm of challenges facing these things. Of course, the climate change we've seen, and the effects of climate change. And I mean, I know we're talking here after a nice rainstorm and you think everything's fine, but we've all seen what this last winter was like, and just, you know, unprecedented for how mild it was. And we're going to be feeling the effects of this, and the Great Salt Lake and the Bear River Marsh are going to be feeling the effects of this last winter in a very short amount of time, if they aren't already. And again, we've had dry times before, but with the climate change going on, we've never had things coming this frequently, this sustained. This really is kind of uncharted territory. And then on top of that, we've still got the agricultural demands. Alfalfa growing takes a lot of water. And then just the urbanization that is taking place all around, north and east and south of the Great Salt Lake, as Utah's population continues to grow. And the projections are that it will continue to grow. And that, of course, just takes a lot of water as well. And so between climate change and urbanization and agricultural use, the demands on the Bear River have never been higher. And yet they don't seem to have capped out either. It seems that they're just growing. And the lake and the marsh, the birds that are dependent upon them are ultimately dependent on that water. And with the current projections, I don't mean to be to end that book on a Debbie Downer note, but the idea is it's time to do something. It really is time to do something and to make some decisions based not just on current needs, but on future needs. And by future, you know, talking decades in the future. And I know that there's a lot of money, even federal money. President Trump has promised, or at least talked about, you know, $1 billion that he's going to pump into saving the Great Salt Lake. I think that's good and bad. I think when people see money, they think problem solved. We can do, you know, technological things to get water into the lake. But honestly, more than money going into the lake, we need water going into the lake. And I'm not convinced myself that money being thrown at the lake means more water. I think it's got to be a change in attitude, a change in approach, a change in all sorts of things. And I don't know that money is always the answer for those things. And so, just like I say, it was going to take, you know, close to a miracle to save that wounded hand canvas bag. It's going to take, I don't know if we're quite at the miracle stage, but it's going to take some extraordinary effort on the part of people in Utah, on the part of politicians. It's going to take some effort. It's going to take some sacrifice. It's going to take a real reorientation if we're going to save the marsh and the lake.
Well, we're at the end of our time here. Interesting book's out now. It's called A Reed Shaken with the Wind, A Human and Natural History of the Bear River Marsh. We've been talking with the author, Andrew Hedges. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.